What are you going back to? What are you demanding now?
Well, Flint needs a full-on humanitarian effort because Snyder has said that all levels of government have failed Flint. Really, there was only one level, and that was because of the emergency manager law. We did not have access to local democracy. We did not have agency. And we really need—this is a public health disaster. We at the state sites, we could only get one case of water per day, and that is not enough to meet the needs of the community.
Right now is your most important demand.
We need a public health disasters declaration by President Obama.
We're going to leave it there. We're going to continue the conversation and post online at democracynow.org. Naira Sharif, coordinator with Flint Democracy Defense League, and Melissa Mays, activist and founder of What Are You Fighting For? This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
KBOO Portland. The time is now 5 p.m., and coming up next is your KBOO Evening News.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Smoldering Fires, produced by Passenart. The play runs from March 11th through April 10th at the Interstate Firehouse Cultural Center in Portland. Smoldering Fires explores how to apply the ideas and struggles of the civil rights movement to contemporary city life through the point of view of two young friends who differ in temperament and approach. Again, that's Smoldering Fires, March 11th through April 10th at the Interstate Firehouse Cultural Center, 5340 Northeast Interstate Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Tim DeChristopher Lecture, Wielding the Power of Vulnerability, Thursday, April 7th at 7 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church in Portland. Tim DeChristopher, as bidder 70, disrupted a Bureau of Land Management oil and gas auction in 2008 by outbidding oil companies for land parcels around Arches and Canyonlands National Parks in Utah. His actions led to a 21-month imprisonment. Again, that's a lecture by Tim DeChristopher titled Wielding the Power of Vulnerability, Thursday, April 7th at 7 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church, 1211 Southwest Main Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the 13th anniversary of the Iraq invasion is tomorrow. KBOO talks to an organizer of the weekly Portland anti-war rally.
Even with the Affordable Care Act, many Oregonians are still unable to afford coverage. We hear more from the Oregon Center for Public Policy.
And today is the last day of Sunshine Week, where journalists and information lovers celebrate the Freedom of Information Act.
Good evening. This is KBOO Evening News for Friday, March 18th, 2016. I'm David Kesters.
And I'm Linda Olson Osterland. Tomorrow marks the 13th anniversary of the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003 and the 5th anniversary of the U.S. bombing of Libya. KBOO's Emmy Kudzi spoke with Dan Handelman of Peace and Justice Works, an organization that holds an anti-war rally every Friday in Pioneer Square in downtown Portland.
This is Emmy Kudzi with KBOO Evening News, and I'm here with Dan Handelman of Peace and Justice Works. Can you tell us why March 19th is important?
Well, March 19th marks the anniversary of two U.S. wars from the last decade and a half. The first one that started was the U.S. invasion of Iraq in March of 2003. And there was also a U.S. war, U.S./NATO war on Libya that started, I'm not sure if it was coincidentally or on purpose, on March 19th in 2011. We were very aware that the attack on Libya was going to come. We were, had put out alerts that if the U.S. attacked Libya, that we should come out for an emergency demonstration. And in fact, we were marching around on the 9th anniversary, or I guess it was the 8th anniversary of the Iraq War in 2011, when we heard over the radio that the bombing of Libya had started. So it's just one of these very frustrating things, and I know that people out there are probably sick and tired of protesting wars, and I'm sure the people on the other end of the bombs are even more sick of being subjected to the wars.
And is there anything else you think people can be doing right now to stop war?
Well, obviously, we are in the middle of an election season, and there are candidates who are trying to make all sorts of promises. And to the extent possible, if we can get those candidates to promise that they're not going to use war as a main tool of their foreign policy, that would be a lovely thing.
Thanks for that info. Is there anything else you'd like our listeners to know?
Okay, so tonight's rally, the Portland Peace for Response Coalition, which is and a different organization from Peace and Justice Works, but they have been out on the streets every week since a little bit after the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan in 2001. And this week is 750 weeks since that first rally. And I think that's a tremendous accomplishment. I mean, just the longevity of it, rain or shine, snow, whatever, they've been out there. And, you know, we come down about once a month or every couple of months we co-sponsor the rally with them like we're doing this week. But I just think that listeners should support Portland Peace Response and every Friday at 5 o'clock come down to Pioneer Square if they can and just, you know, put their bodies out there and let people know.
I'm Emmy Kunze with KBOO News.
A second defendant in the Mulhare Wildlife Refuge occupation has waived his right to an attorney. Ryan Bundy faces life in prison on four federal charges of conspiracy and weapons violations stemming from the armed takeover in the refuge late last year. U.S. District Judge Anna J. Brown accepted the withdrawal of Andrew Bates as Bundy's attorney. Bates filed to withdraw last week, saying that the attorney-client relationship has completely broken down. A standby defense attorney has been approved, and Bundy could reverse his decision before his trial, expected to begin by September.
With the passage of the Affordable Care Act, millions of Americans were finally able to get health insurance. However, many people have found themselves in the position where they are still unable to afford coverage. For more on this, we go to KBOO News reporter Jenna Yokoyama.
If you're a low-income Oregonian, you may have found yourself in the tough position of not being able to afford health insurance. To learn more about this, I spoke with Janet Bauer from the Oregon Center of Public Policy. Can you tell us who is not getting health care?
Well, our organization, Oregon Center for Public Policy, looked at some recent information from the U.S. Census and found that many Oregonians remain uninsured. Specifically, 381,000 Oregonians were uninsured that year, despite some substantial gains in coverage. The groups that are more likely to be uninsured are working-age adults, that adults between the ages of 18 and 64. Oregonians between the ages of 25 and 34, one in five of them were uninsured that year. And that was a much higher rate than all other age groups that we looked at.
Why is this group so disproportionately affected?
We have some ideas. We think that it seems to be an affordability problem. For instance, individuals who are low income, that's below 200% of the federal poverty level, are much more likely to be uninsured than higher income individuals. So for that reason, we suspect that it's a function of being able to afford premiums. And when we're looking at young adults, they are less likely to be working at a job where they are offered health coverage. So they are more likely to be shopping on Oregon's Exchange. And even with the generous federal subsidies, they still, if their incomes are low, they still may be unable to easily afford those plans.
And could you also speak about the effect on the communities of color?
Yes. We found that for some communities of color in Oregon, they were more vulnerable to being uninsured than others. Those groups are Hawaiian and Pacific Islanders, 18% of them were uninsured, Latinos, over 20% were uninsured, and American Indian and Alaska Natives about the same rate. And that's compared to non-Hispanic whites in Oregon who were uninsured at about 8%. So that's at a level much lower. These are big discrepancies.
And what do you account for that discrepancy?
I think that it has something to do with income. Secondly, I think that it may have something to do with access to coverage for some groups. There are some legally present immigrants who are barred from Medicaid, although they would otherwise qualify. And so these are individuals who have very low incomes, and they can shop on the exchange, but they're running into the same problem of not being able to afford the coverage, most likely.
So for Oregonians who are lacking insurance and fall into these categories, what kind of relief can they possibly look for to get some help?
We have been working with a coalition of other groups, many of whom represent these particular communities, on a solution to the affordability problem for low-income individuals. And it's a program called the Basic Health Program. It's an option for states under the Affordable Care Act. And it has the potential to provide much more affordable coverage to low-income individuals who aren't eligible for Medicaid.
And would that be implemented at all in this year, or are they looking at something like 2017?
Yes, it is a couple years out because of logistical reasons for setting up new programs, but we believe that it is a promising option for Oregon and one that we need to be working towards to provide a better health insurance structure in Oregon for Oregonians to close the remaining coverage gaps here.
And so would that completely close the gap, or would there still be any sort of people remaining, or would it really be able to make up for that subsidy?
It would not completely cover the gaps, but it would go a long way to covering them, closing the gap. You know, we believe there needs to be solutions to address all of the gaps in coverage, because access to health care with the support of health insurance is really important for people's general success in life.
To find out more about the Oregon Center of Public Policy's most recent analysis and the Basic Health Program, go to www.ocpp.org. For the KBOO Evening News, I'm Jenny Yokoyama.
Today is the last day of Sunshine Week, where journalists and public interest groups promote governmental accountability through transparency. Here's KBOO reporter Robin Ryan on how you can see who the city of Portland is writing checks to and for how much.
To finish off our Sunshine Week of sharing transparency tools, we're going fresh and local for Friday. First, by way of Portland's online vendor checkbook, and then a review of a locally based organization developed to educate folks on how to build their own transparency tools. In June of 2015, Portland's Office of Management and Finance launched a database that makes accessible payments to companies the city does business with. Records can be searched by individual bureau or alphabetically listed vendors who provide services and products to the city. Given the hot topic housing issues in the area have become, the example in play will look at payments issued by the Portland Housing Bureau, which has been overseen by City Council member Dan Saltzman since the summer of 2013. The Bureau issued 1,775 checks for a total of $51.4 million between July of 2014 and June of 2015. For the 7 months of the current fiscal year, the Bureau has paid another $28.5 million with 951 checks. Additional details about the payments made include what services were rendered, though some might characterize descriptors of miscellaneous and/or professional services as a bit ambiguous. The list of funds being drawn from can be found by clicking on tabs at the bottom of the homepage. The Convention Center Area Debt Service Fund, for example, issued 3 checks in 1 day to U.S. Bank for a total of $5.8 million. The Bureau that wrote those checks is the Office of Finance and Management, and for the 17 months accounted for in the records available, they've paid out nearly $380 million. opportunities to develop tools like the ones we've shared throughout the week do knock, and right here in River City at Hack, Oregon. There they abide by a motto of making public information public knowledge, and though their doors haven't yet been opened a full year, projects like Behind the Curtain follows the flow of political funds in Oregon. The data about last year's ballot measure 92, the effort to see genetically modified foods labeled, include the fact that just 14% of the money spent on the measure came from within the state. The top individual donor was Tom Hormel, with a $500,000 contribution in support of the measure, which was at odds with the corporation his grandfather started, as they made two different $425,000 donations to see the bill defeated. I'm Robin Ryan, and you're listening to KBOO News.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin. This will be followed by Bread and Roses at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. For Portland's weather tonight, it will be mostly cloudy with a low of 44. Tomorrow will continue to be mostly cloudy with a high of 62. And then there's a slight chance of showers tomorrow night with a low of 49. Today in history, in 1922, Mahatma Gandhi was sentenced to prison in India after calling for mass civil disobedience, which included boycotting British educational institutions and law courts, not working for the British-controlled government, and a boycott of foreign-made goods. In his speeches, he always emphasized that the use of violence on both sides was wrong. He was sentenced to 6 years, but released after two. The quote of the day is from Gandhi, who said, quote, "You must be the change you wish to see in the world," end quote.
It's 5:16, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Billboards must be living creatures, for they appear to propagate, spreading everywhere, growing to enormous size, shouting corporate messages at us, and even watching and tracking us with their digital eyes. Now, though, rather than billboards becoming human, we humans are becoming billboards. Literally, for the love of money, the National Basketball Association is transforming its chief human asset, that is, basketball players, into advertising placards that run, dribble, leap, twist, and dunk. While individual golfers and race car drivers have long splattered themselves with their sponsors' logos, NBA teams are now planning to become the first major U.S. sports league to sell ad space on their players' game day jerseys. Chancy? Well, yes, but not cheap. Team owners expect brand-name corporations to pay at least $100 million to have their logos plastered on the chests of basketball stars. Calling this a stylistic move, the mammon-worshipping owners say the ads will be modest, just a 2.5-inch patch displaying the corporate brand of, say, Budweiser, Bank of America, Hooters, or Viagra. The ad size seems small, but ESPN's high-def TV cameras will focus on them and show them to viewers hundreds of times in every game. And of course, to squeeze ever more cash out of each human billboard, both the owners and advertisers will steadily expand the commercial space to cover the entire uniform. This is Jim Hightower saying, actually, I'm not 100% opposed to ads on uniforms, for I've been saying since the first Clinton administration that presidents and Congress critters should have to put the corporate logos of their big funders on their suits, shirts, skirts, etc., so we the people can know at a glance whom they really represent. It's my Truth in Politics proposal, and I hope you'll push it too.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at hightowerlowdown.org.
Nearly every state has seen an increase in elderly prisoners, and with that increase comes higher health care costs. According to a report from the Pew Charitable Trust, corrections departments report that health care for older prisoners costs between 4 and 8 times what it does for younger prisoners. To explain the sharp rise in aging prison populations, correction officials point to two factors. One is a steady increase in the rate of older adults entering prison. The second is changes enacted in the Get Tough on Criminals 1990s that resulted in longer prison sentences. In addition, people sent to prison are generally less healthy than the overall population. Many states have taken steps to reduce their prison populations by releasing nonviolent inmates or by diverting some offenders to community programs before sending them to prison. Corrections officials say those reforms alone will do little to decrease the population of older prisoners who are serving mandatory sentences or who have committed violent crimes. Inmate advocates say the programs are often so cumbersome and restrictive that few older prisoners are able to take advantage of them.
Lead in the water supply continues to plague the people of Flint, Michigan. KBOO's Natasha Delapine spoke with Executive Director Lonnie Scott of political media organization Progress Michigan for more.
I think that Flint has been an absolute disaster, and we've been working with the families in Flint to try and make sure that folks are held accountable for the fact that it's been 2 years that poison water has been coming out of the taps in Flint, and there are still no real movement on replacing the pipes and a permanent fix for the residents of Flint. The latest has been that Governor Snyder is asking or has spent and started to spend $1.2 million in legal defense money, $800,000 of which is highlighted in the contract as for his criminal defense. And even though there are no charges that have been filed yet, Michigan law is very clear that no public dollars should be spent for that type of legal defense. So Progress Michigan has filed a complaint with the Secretary of State's office, who oversees our Legal Defense Fund Act, claiming and alleging that the governor, we believe the governor, has violated that act by using public dollars and asking taxpayers to pay for his criminal defense fund. You know, I think it's ludicrous. I mean, people in Flint, Michigan have been paying for poison water for 2 years. They pay some of the highest water rates in the country and haven't been able to use their water. And the governor offered them a 60% of cut or a refund of 60%. They calculated how much they thought people used for eating and drinking and bathing and gave them a refund of that amount as if all of the water isn't poison, and then comes and asks taxpayers to pay 100% of his legal bills and criminal defense for a criminal defense attorney.
Is Governor Rick Snyder being held accountable for the disaster in Flint, Michigan?
There's no one yet who has been held responsible. There are several investigations that are ongoing. There are criminal investigations. There are civil lawsuits that have been filed against the governor and the state. But at this point, still going through all the documents, Michigan is one of only two states that allows our governor's office as well as our legislature to be expressly exempt from our Freedom of Information Act law, which means that getting this information has been a slow, tedious process, that the governor was not compelled to initially turn it over because those internal emails and those things were protected under the Freedom of Information Act by his office being exempt. So it's not something that they had to readily supply to us. The governor's office has started releasing some of that information selectively. And, you know, I believe that in the end, we will certainly have more details as those investigations play out. But as for right now, there's no one who has been charged with any kind of wrongdoing in a criminal way for the Flint water crisis.
What key differences have you noticed between the current politicians on today's story and politicians you've worked with previously, namely Alma Wheeler Smith and Jeff Irwin?
Well, Representative Jeff Irwin is actually on the Flint Investigation Committee that was just formed in the legislature in Michigan. He heard testimony today from folks, and certainly Representative Alma Wheeler Smith. I would say that the difference is I believe that they were always forthright and honest with folks, and I don't believe that that's been the governing culture in Michigan since around 2011 when the governor came in and took control and had total control of both the House and the Senate. I mean, that's not a blanket statement. I think that there are a lot of good elected officials out there, but certainly I believe that I worked for two who were real public servants who had the public's best interest at heart, who always fought hard for their districts. and for the people of Michigan, and that certainly doesn't seem to be the case with some of the folks who have been really mishandling the Flint situation.
What do you think there could be in the future of infrastructure in your community and ours?
I think that Flint is just the tip of the iceberg. I mean, I believe that Flint, Flint, Michigan could be any poor city in America when we allow our democracy to be stripped away with laws like the emergency manager law, and when we follow Republican austerity policies that have really led our cities, townships, school districts to the brink of disaster through their lack of funding. And I think that really the danger here in Michigan is that I don't believe that Flint is the only community that is facing these types of challenges. I think that we have to start to invest in our infrastructure, and I think that we have to replace democracy in the state of Michigan by getting rid of the undemocratic emergency manager law.
Thank you, Mr. Scott.
No problem. Thank you.
This has been Lonnie Scott of ProgressMichigan.org, and I am Natasha Delapine reporting for KBOO News.
United States military personnel will be punished for their role in carrying out airstrikes on a hospital in Kunduz, Afghanistan. Last October, 42 people were killed when a Doctors Without Borders hospital was bombed by a United States Air Force gunship. The aircraft fired 211 shells at the hospital for more than 29 minutes before commanders called for them to stop. The attack happened as NATO-backed Afghan forces fought Taliban insurgents to regain control of the city. Individuals most closely associated with the incident have been suspended from their duties and referred for administrative action. None will face criminal charges. U.S. defense officials told the Associated Press the punishments may range from simply being told not to do something again to letters of reprimand, which could block military personnel from being promoted. Both officers and enlisted personnel, but no generals, were among those who will face disciplinary action. The Pentagon is expected to make an official announcement of exactly what the punishments will be within the next few weeks. Doctors Without Borders have said that the attack was, quote, abhorrent and a grave violation of international humanitarian law, end quote.
The North Korean government fired a ballistic missile into the Sea of Japan today in violation of a United Nations war resolution. The North Korean military already tested a nuclear weapon in January and then again another ballistic missile last month. South Korea's Joint Chiefs of Staff reported the missile flew 500 miles before crashing off the coast of North Korea. North Korea has devoted considerable resources to building nuclear weapons, estimated at 10 to 16 warheads, and is working on an intercontinental ballistic missile for delivering them. New tougher UN sanctions were imposed earlier this month against the country.
The European Union has signed a deal with the Turkish government to send all refugees and migrants arriving in Europe back to Turkey starting on Sunday. The EU agreement specifically focuses on refugees in Greece, where hundreds of thousands of people fleeing violence have used rubber rafts to float across the Aegean Sea. The issue comes in the midst of a renewed negotiations between Turkey and the European Union to allow the country to join the EU. In return, the European Union has promised to speed up its payment of 3 billion euros to help Syrian refugees in Turkey. Turkish officials say they promise to treat the refugees in accordance with international law and not send them back to the countries they were fleeing from.
You may be familiar with the Peanuts character Pigpen, a boy so filthy he has a free-floating aura of dirt, dust, and flies that follow him everywhere. Don't take it personally, but new research out of the University of Oregon suggests that we are all more like Pigpen than we'd probably care to admit. Each of us emits and carries our own personalized microbial cloud, according to a study of U of O's biology and the Built Environment Center. The cloud is comprised of microbes emitted by our bodies at a rate of about 1 million per hour and can spread as far as 2 feet away from us. The microbes are bacteria, fungi, viruses, and algae, and run the gamut from healthy to unhealthy to completely neutral, and each person's cloud is distinct to them. James Meadow, the lead researcher on the paper, said that when we enter a room, we change its microbial ecosystem in a matter of hours, and then when two people are attracted to one another, their microbial clouds may also be communicating. Researchers are exploring the implications and applications of this insight, from building design From buildings designed to maximize the healthy microbes in our clouds to the possibility of new methods of identification for law enforcement and governments.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News, and this is a volunteer-produced newscast. We encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Emmy Kunzis, Jenna Yokoyama, Natasha Delphine, Robin Ryan, and Lisa Loving. The producer is David Kesters. Our engineer is Ian Gadberry. The KABU Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews or look for us on Twitter at KABU News. You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm Linda Olson-Osterlund.
And I'm David Kesters. Coming up on KABU next Monday morning, more talk radio with Cecil and Celeste, the Old Mole Variety Hour, Air Cascadia with Chris and Dre, Locus Focus hosted by Barbara Bernstein, and Health Watch with David Naiman speaking on Maya Shatrit Klein's pioneering book, The Dirt Cure, which will forever transform the way you think about children's health. Stay tuned now for Counterspin coming up next.